Okay, so on a score of 1 to 10, how would you rate Stephen Poloz?
That's a tough one. I'll go like with the current value of the loonie, I'll go like 74.9.
Oh, that's just perfect.
Mostly Money, Mostly Canadian podcast with your host, Preet Banerjee.
Welcome back to Mostly Money. I'm your host, Preet Banerjee, and on the show today, I'll be speaking to Luke Kawa, a reporter at Bloomberg who covers and opines on economic and business news and is definitely someone you want to follow on the Twitter. And as usual, before I introduce Luke, thank you again to the listeners who have left star ratings on iTunes. Special thanks this week to Stuart2000, Buff Good Stuff, love the name, who wants Ben Rabideau on more often, a very popular request, which was echoed by the next commenter, David Toyne, from our friends over at Steady Hand Funds, who was also a fan in particular of the Ben Rabideau episode. And finally, Northern BC, who is digging the conversation on robo-advisors. And just a reminder, if you haven't done so yet, I really do appreciate you taking 5 seconds to leave a rating on iTunes. And if you want to take the additional time to write in a comment on top of that, I do read them all. And now, on to today's guest. Luke Kawa is a reporter at Bloomberg based in New York City. In his young but very accomplished career, he has written for Business Insider, The Globe and Mail, and Maclean's, and more. He is one of the Twitter accounts to follow if you want to keep your finger on the pulse of the economy in Canada, the U.S., and frankly, around the world. And if I'm not mistaken, the principal secretary to the Prime Minister of Canada singled him out as someone that everyone should be taking note of. Did you know that?
Hey, it's good to hear. Did my mom write that bio?
No. This is all self-sourced, all from taking in the tweets that people have, showering praise your way. And I have to say, you know, you're a pretty young guy. How old are you?
I am right now 26 years old. I'm on the wrong side of the 20s.
Oh, don't.
It's been weighing on me lately.
I'm 39. I'm turning 40 this year. So, you know, you can't expect any sympathy from me. So you're not going to get it.
Just start doing your age in U.S. terms. Like right now, I'm what, like 19, 20?
Right. Well, as I was saying, you know, I'm blown away by that. At 26, you are incredibly well-respected in the Twitter sphere when it comes to economic news and opinions. And so it is my pleasure and honor to have you as a guest on the show. And so why don't we start with your background? It's going to be short because you're so bloody young. But where did you study in school and sort of take us through the progression of school and how you ended up where you are today?
Well, sure. But, you know, since I'm a millennial and we job hop like crazy, we'll actually probably go long, you know, a little longer than you thought.
Sure.
But started high school right here, St. Michael's College. The first economics class I ever had was Mr. Zanardo there. And it was tougher than some of my classes at university, to be honest. But,
really?
You know, kind of got right into it. And I'm ending up high school in 2008. Which is, you know, if you're going to be getting into economics and interested in economics, you're seeing it in the papers every day. You're
right.
Seeing the textbooks being rewritten both on monetary policy and on fiscal policy. So it's every day you were kind of living the subject more and more, and you saw everyone else around you being forced to live it. And, you know, I really didn't know what I wanted to study at school. I went to St. John's University in New York, but I remember my dad telling me, and again, this is as the financial crisis is unfolding, he said, even when the economy is completely in the tank, when everything's gone to hell, you still need economists to tell you how crappy things really are. And so I just thought this would be a great place, a rather sticky employment potential. So studied econ at St. John's, majored in that, had a lot of fun, and don't know if I'd recommend the school on its academic merits, but New York City, heck of a good time,
right.
Lifelong friends, yada, yada, yada,
mm-hmm.
That whole charade. out of school, I actually, my first job out of school was playing baseball for the hometown Toronto Maple Leafs.
So that was your job?
That was my first job. It paid in gas money and maybe a little extra, but
wow.
my career-ending injury kind of weighed on me. They discovered that as the season went on, so it was just a one-season thing, and then I was out.
And sorry, what position did you play?
I was a pitcher.
You were a pitcher. Okay. Yes.
So, you know, cracking. I think I could start for the Blue Jays nowadays if you be a genius. And who's this guy starting to? Yeah, nobody knows his name.
Oh, but, right. You're a Yankees fan, aren't you? So you had to put in your Blue Jays dig, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know when this podcast will go to air. This could look like a very bad comment, but right now, for all concerned, the Blue Jays are 10 games behind the Yankees.
I think that'll age well.
But moving on. So I just kind of started, you know, blogging about generally fiscal policy and the different electoral platforms heading into the U.S. election. And still to this day, the first place that ever answered a job application for me was Business Insider, when I was just, you know, sending anything out, just trying to get a gig writing. And they took me on as an intern. And that, you know, set everything in motion for me. I got to, you know, meet and work with Joe Wiesenthal, who continues to be boss and one of my heroes in the industry to this day. He's mm-hmm. a big shot at Bloomberg, the stalwart on Twitter. He's the guy in digital media and financial media. So a Business Insider for 5 months, then started up a Canadian only kind of a financial econ website for a while.
Yeah, in Canada, right?
Business in Canada, yeah.
That's when I started following you. I was reading your commentary.
You were an early adopter then. So Canadians spend, like, besides South Koreans, most time per capita on the internet, I think, or something crazy like that.
Right, yeah.
And I think we're fairly underserviced still as a eco-financial market. I know you're trying to change that. I'm trying to change that. A lot of folks are trying to change that. But it seemed like a great place to kind of get into and make my mark. And had a lot of fun doing it, had the opportunity to live at home and the support to do that while I was kind of carrying out that crazy mission.
True millennial.
Yep. And then five months at the Globe and Mail from late 2014 to 2015. And then I've been at Bloomberg ever since, you know, May 2015 to now. So coming up on the 2 year mark.
Wow. That's a huge record for you. Years.
Yeah, 2 years. It's a longer commitment than I've ever made to anything, you know?
Okay. And so that's interesting. I mean, I want to ask you about that. I mean, I have so many questions, but so when it comes to, you know, career trajectory changes, you've had a few, and you sort of mentioned jokingly that, you know, as a millennial, you do kind of tend to see people in that demographic changing more often than not. How long do you see yourself staying at any one place? Like, do you have 5-year plans? How does that work?
I'm taking it very, very day by day. In fact, that's what I love about my job the most. I'm on the cross asset team at Bloomberg, mm-hmm. and that's partially a fancy way of saying that when I wake up every morning, I have absolutely no clue what I'll be doing.
Oh, that's cool.
I have no idea whether I'll be writing about China, about trends in corporate bond purchases, about the Federal Reserve, about the Bank of Canada. I have no idea. And that kind of, when you can wake up and maybe get a half an idea of what you're doing based on the first refresh on your Twitter feed, it's incredibly exciting. It's incredibly stimulating. It helps keep me up, and I feel like I'm doing something new every day. I feel like I'm having, you know, a career change a week, and that's all I want. It keeps me fresh.
All right, so that'll keep you happy for the foreseeable future. We'll get back to that in a second, but one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you is to educate the listeners a little bit on some of like the Econ 101 kind of stuff and things that maybe they want to know about with respect to the Canadian economy and what's going on with Trump and protectionism and all that stuff. And the first question I actually wanted to talk to you about was just explaining the difference between monetary policy and fiscal policy. So like I said, real Econ 101 stuff. But I think there's a lot of people who may not know the difference. So let's start there, and then we'll work from there.
Okay, beautiful. And I heard supply curves slope upward, demand curves slope downward. There's an X in the spot. They meet in the middle. It's beautiful.
Right.
But so fiscal policy is basically the government's decisions on taxing and spending powers. So it's very much as simple as that. There's, you know, two different ways to define GDP as we do it. And there's the income basis and the spending or expenditure basis. And the T for tax is where you get it on the income side. And the G for spending is where you get it on the on the product expenditure side. So that's very simple. That's where that comes from.
And what's the purpose of making changes to fiscal policy? What are governments trying to do when they manipulate that?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Insights into Teens, a podcast series exploring the issues and challenges of today's youth. Talking to real teens about real teen problems. Explore issues from braces to puberty, social anxiety to financial responsibility. Each week, we talk about the topics concerning today's youth. We look at how the issues affect teens, how to cope with these issues, and how parents, friends, and loved ones can help teens handle these challenges. Check out our video episodes on youtube.com/insightsintothings. Catch our audio versions on podcast.insightsintoteens.com or on the web at insightsintothings.com.
Well, I mean, the cynic would say they're just trying to, you know, get the next vote.
Right.
And if we're going to be honest, in terms of what drive most changes in fiscal policy, I think that would be your easy baseline answer would be to take the cynical view and say, okay, well, which demographic is this pleasing
right.
in terms of this policy change? And I think in terms of the previous government, in terms of boutique tax credits, that was something that was, you know, fairly simple where you could see that in terms of, you know, targeting your support through fiscal policy decisions. Were those necessarily economically efficient? Most economists would tell you no, just more complexity in the tax code, generally not a good idea by and large. But, you know, that's not to say that this current government is doing great either. So that's a cynical answer. But
in theory,
governments are probably, that's a great question. They're probably looking to contribute to, I would ideally look for them to try to manage the business cycle much as a central bank does. So, you know, economic shocks come from everywhere. They come from left field. You never see them coming. But, you know, they're there. The Canadian housing market could implode tomorrow or so I'm told. So in the event that happens, governments have a fairly unlimited in, you know, a sovereign nation where you can print your own currency. They have a fairly unlimited ability to then, you know, harness that printing press and stimulate demand. If people have been laid off because, say, China's decided, okay, we're just going to quit this credit-driven binge. We're going to, you know, stop buying commodities for a while. And, you know, that affects the demand for commodities. A lot of people get laid off.
Mm-hmm.
The government can kind of step in and say, okay, well, there's no need for social unrest and for people to be going hungry because of this. Why don't we expand unemployment insurance? Why don't we expand the terms of it, the assistance we're providing, as well as the level of support to kind of cushion the blow? You know, deficits be damned. We'll just, you know, blow it up for a little and, you know, things are good. But on the flip side, this is the part governments generally don't get to, is ideally when times are great,
right,
to be kind of draw back on the deficits, to be kind of move back towards surplus. That was, you know, to the credit. That's what the previous conservative government did kind of do well in keeping a fiscal anchor that they wanted to hit and getting back to that by, you know, roughly the time they said they would. So it's kind of balancing out and smoothing out the business cycle, which kind of meshes perfectly well with what monetary policy is supposed to do. So the government ideally would kind of smooth the business cycle by the way of their taxing and spending powers and changes in that. However, central banks are working with a different set of tools. They are trying to smooth the business cycle based on changes to, you know, generally now interest rates, although the toolkit is definitely expanding there. And even in Canada, they've at least at the Bank of Canada admitted the possibility of using more tools to fight the next downturn if it ever comes.
Okay, so before we get to that, so let's sort of say, all right, so fiscal policy for the average listener's perspective is, let's say the economy runs into trouble, say 2008, 2009, massive amount of spending, hopes to stimulate the economy. And in theory, when things get sort of back to capacity, then you taper off the spending and pay off the debt and then run a surplus and so on and so forth. And then the central banks, the Bank of Canada, they will use what's called monetary policy. So let's now define what is monetary policy.
So monetary policy, I would loosely define as changes in the price of money,
mm-hmm.
And central banks have a limited ability to control that. They do that by setting short-term interest rates and kind of hoping that filters out through the rest of through the yield curve, through longer dated borrowing costs, through, you know, the costs of getting a mortgage, through the costs of governments, you know, issuing longer term debt to fund profitable investment. And the money supply would have been the old way of thinking about that or going about that. But mm-hmm. right now it's mainly through the interest rate channel that central banks try to either tamp down on inflation, on pricing pressures by raising interest rates and trying to make things more expensive to borrow. So maybe you don't. And, you know, maybe that house doesn't get built if you're not going to then eventually take out the mortgage to borrow it. Maybe companies don't expand and, you know, that demand for money increases, which is an inflationary upward pressure.
So the flip side to that is if you lower interest rates to encourage borrowing, not only would you have the household borrowing, which we've seen, you would expect that companies would borrow and invest. But that hasn't really been happening for the last little while. And that's been one of the things people are wondering, what's it going to take for businesses to get off the sidelines and do something with these low interest rates, which are so accommodative. So what's the paradox here? What's going on?
Well, the paradox here is I think a lot of this has to do with lingering scars from the financial crisis. And also, I think it still has to do with relatively basic economics, supply and demand. I think it goes back to the idea that, you know, in the crisis, what happened was there was a heck of a lot of people laid off. And still that healing process has been slow in coming. And it's in Canada, it's been had its regional ups and downs like crazy. You know, Alberta went from the top of the pack to the bottom of the pack. So in that sense, sorry.
No problem. Yeah.
Sorry, just knocked the mic there.
But we've started drinking, as my listeners know, that occasionally, you know, the Scotch cabinet is open to all my guests who come here. So we'll chalk that up to you know, getting too
enthusiastic.
Too enthusiastic with the Scotch.
But so essentially, I chalk this up to wage pressure still fairly subdued. I don't think we're at full employment yet in Canada. I think mm-hmm. the Bank of Canada would agree to that. And, you know, if you're a business and you saw essentially people that did make that investment in the height of the boom, they were the ones that really wore it the worst. They're the ones right. that have the most excess capacity, the idle and closed factories. So if you can add just one person, one unit of labor, labor is a lot more flexible than capital in terms of what you can add to sure. to boost your production, then you're going to try and get as much out of that as possible. And I think you're going to try to maximize how much labor you're adding before you finally say, okay, I've done all I can do. I've hired every available skilled person in the city and their wages are going up like crazy. It just makes a lot more sense right now to, you know, spread them out. We're going to take the last 10 people we hired and set them up at this new location. That's where they're going to work, buy all new equipment. And, you know, I'm confident in the visibility of that demand for my good or service that I'm providing, that I'm willing to make that bigger upfront cost to boost production. So the big answer is I don't think we've gotten to that point yet where businesses are confident. That's a right. really big cop-out answer. Uncertainty is what you say when you really don't know what to say.
But I think there's merit to that. I mean, you know, when I talk to small business owners, they're not that confident about the future. I mean, a lot of people have talked about the fragility of the Canadian economy over the last little while. There's nothing that's really said, hey, listen, we're gangbusters again. Everyone is looking at the number of possible shocks internally, externally to the economy, and they're more worried than they are optimistic. So if that's your outlook as a business owner, why would you make the investment now when you think, you know what, I'm not on sure ground yet? So there's that. And then there's also this growing automation, right? So there's a lot of jobs that whenever there's a downturn, there's cutbacks expected. And this is where sometimes productivity can be enhanced through the use of automation because technology keeps on increasing. And that's something that I don't think people, especially voters in various elections around the world, have maybe not appreciated as much as they should have.
I mean, there's something to do to that, of course. But if productivity were very high recently, I would say, okay, yeah, the robots are coming, they're winning the battle, they're taking our jobs. But Where do we see that really in markets right now in the US and in Canada? I don't think anywhere. Productivity is kind of flagging. It's very low. I don't think you can make the argument that the robots have won yet. In fact, I would make the argument that they're not winning fast enough as our population is getting older and people are retiring from the labor force. I need some more robots. And also, I'm very self-serving here. Oh, it's been kind of proven that, you know, creative jobs, for instance, blogging, are jobs that probably the robots would take last. So I don't think Bloomberg Automation is coming for my specific job anytime soon. So right. I feel very free to say that.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So let's go back to monetary policy. And who's the guy in charge now of monetary policy in Canada? For educate our listeners.
So I'm going to give you the top two because I think they're both great. And I'm a big fan of especially the senior deputy governor. Uh-huh. So
you want to start with Carolyn then?
Yes, I will start with Carolyn Wilkins as a senior deputy governor. She was she's been an advisor earlier at the bank. When she became the number two, her promotion was, I mean, it's, you never really know who the front runners are these are, but she doesn't have a PhD, which is apparently a big deal sometimes, even though previous number twos at the bank, they haven't necessarily had a PhD, mm-hmm. but that was the knock against her at the time. But she's written very well on something that I think continues to be a guiding light at the bank. Do you lean against asset bubbles? Do you, if you're worried about home prices being too high and people taking on too much risk, do you hike rates to kind of say, okay, we're gonna try and tamp down on activity and make sure things don't get too crazy here and get into those places that maybe macroprudential policy, that maybe things like the foreign buyers tax aren't reaching? And Carolyn Wilkins, in a 2004 paper she co-authored, said, no, we don't know enough about whether things have already passed, whether we've passed the flip side, and we're just really making things worse. It's best to take a do-no-harm approach and let other people deal with it. I think that more or less does define how the bank has dealt with these pressures under the governor, the new governor, Stephen Poloz.
Right. Okay, so Stephen Poloz came to the Bank of Canada. He was previously at the Bank of Canada. And I forget where he went to after that, but he was president and CEO of Export Development Canada. And that has sort of followed him and how people view him as in his role as the governor of the Bank of Canada. A lot of people say he wants a lower loonie because that favors exporters. So what's your view on that?
So I kind of view it as, you know, the good old WWE or WWF heels, you know. They come to the arena and you come to the arena to watch them and you want to root against them and you know what you're getting and you think you know what you're getting. I think Poloz was kind of forced into a situation where he had no other choice mm-hmm. but to basically argue for and steer Canada towards a looser, more stimulative monetary policy that does have downward pressure on the loonie. But I'd like to take people back to October 2014.
Okay.
So this is right before kind of OPEC pulled the final rug out from under oil. And we went from, I think we were around like 80, let's call it 80 then. And then we, you know, quickly, you know, we're having it by a year later at least. So at that time, the Bank of Canada kind of had a neutral bias in place. Carney left it with a tightening bias. Mm-hmm. And then Poloz kind of removed the tightening bias, switched to a neutral bias. In October 2014, he put out a paper saying, basically, I'm going to do away with forward guidance. I don't think it offers too much value or should be used in more normal times. And that to me and to others was a signal that, hey, if things go as planned, we're going to be talking about tightening pretty soon. So I don't think his goal is to unnecessarily keep policy loose at all costs. I think he's very responsive to the data. I think he's cautious, as all central bankers have been throughout this cycle, because, you know, they're closer to zero than they are to what rates have ever been in normal times. And another thing I'd add is that, you know, people talk about this lower currency in terms of promoting exports. When the currency goes down, it's usually due to kind of exogenous-ish factors. Mm-hmm. Like in Canada's case, it was the price of oil that was the main contributor to pushing it down.
Yeah.
And then also, look, the biggest thing that happens isn't that exports go up mechanically. the first immediate effect is that imports get crushed.
Right.
So exports are a little more sticky than imports in terms of the response to a currency change. And so I don't really buy the argument that he's the depreciator in chief that, you know, that came along to cripple your purchasing power and make it more expensive for you to travel abroad. I think he's doing the best job he can to try and get the economy to where it needs to be. Is the communication always great? You can quibble, but did we need two rate cuts to help cushion the blow? Yeah, probably.
Okay, so on a score of 1 to 10, how would you rate Stephen Poloz?
That's a tough one. I'll go like with the current value of the loonie, I'll go like 74.9.
Oh, that's just perfect. Okay, so what about Mark Carney? So when he left, he was touted as the rock star of Canadian finance. Has that held up over time?
I think it has, but only because more in England for a time period after Brexit and in the run up to that vote, he really did seem like the only adult in the room at times. Right. So I think that's kind of helped his reputation. What's kind of pushed against it on the other side is that kind of the doomsday forecast that he's been lumped in with pushing, those haven't necessarily come to pass. You know, Paul Krugman, of all people, who wrote on election day in the U.S., basically that the U.S. was about to go to hell. Paul Krugman had the most reasonable take on Brexit, which was, you know, this is more a longer term story about a negative shock to the UK economy that will be reflected in lower wealth over a long period of time. And might there be some more immediate demand side shocks as trade deals fall apart? If you get the hard Brexit, if you get a lot of uncertainty related to people not in the finance industry, especially not knowing what the status of their workers is or London's place as, you know, a clearinghouse for finance, could there be demand shocks associated with this? Yeah, but probably the longer term story is the more important one, and it makes the framing of the Brexit vote a little more reasonable for leavers, I would say.
Okay, so and correct me if I'm wrong, but Carney's term with the Bank of England was initially for 5 years.
I believe that's correct.
And was that recently extended?
It was recently extended, and he's going to stay on to try and be there until the end of the Brexit process, until a deal is reached or not reached and they're out on their own.
And what happens after that? You think he comes back to Canada?
There's a heck of a lot of speculation on that. I can tell you as a news person, it would be great to have him come back in any capacity. He's a very colorful guy. He does have a way with words and incredibly knowledgeable and well-respected with good reason. He's a credit to Canada. We'd be lucky to have him back.
And part of that speculation is that he would come back in a more political bent. Is that what you've been hearing?
I mean, I think everyone's kind of heard, I think everyone's heard the rumors. I think Stephen Gordon at Maclean's did some fabulous work kind of analyzing and picking apart the circumstances with which he was approached with that offer while he was still governor of the Bank of Canada.
Right.
I ideally would like a, kind of separation of church and state thing, but there's no law saying a monetary policy, once he's done with his job, can't come back and do what he wants in politics. So, who knows?
Right. Okay. So while we're talking about this theme of lower for longer, one of the narratives that gets bandied about is this idea of the credit supercycle and how over-leveraged households are, governments are, et cetera. So what are your thoughts on deleveraging or just lower for longer? Do you think that that's just going to be the way it's going to be? Is there a Japanification happening in North America? And can you explain what Japanification means?
Sure. So deleveraging in short, and I'll just go with this. Deleveraging is painful. Even in the best case scenarios, it implies that, we talked about monetary policy setting interest rates to try and help steer behavior in one direction or another. So, that's basically encouraging people to lever up. So the flip side of that is people taking on less leverage, people less activity associated with that on the flip side. So no matter what, it's a deleveraging is, I would associate with a baseline negative compared to whatever reasonable status quo you could have assumed before that.
So translation, it would be bad.
It would be bad. And, you know, just kind of depends on how bad it would be.
Right.
So, but onto Japanification. So I'll give the grand theory. It's not my personal view on Japanification, but essentially Japanification goes, it's Japan is a model for what the fate that awaits every advanced economy. So Japan had kind of an asset bubble crash, tried everything it could do on the monetary policy side, although, you know, some people say it wasn't enough, tried lots on the fiscal side, although, you know, some people say it wasn't enough, and it couldn't get inflation back to where it needed to be. And, you know, it couldn't get really resurgent activity in terms of economic growth. And at the same time, you know, debt ratios are going crazy, but interest rates keep falling. So that's kind of the Japanification conundrum, that no matter how low you put interest rates or stimulate through the fiscal channels that you have, that interest rates are going to sink and there's nothing you can do to kind of get the economy where it needs to be. And, you know, people think that's happening in North America because, you know, what have interest rates done for the past, you know, decade. So, I mean, that's on that part of it. The facts fit the case. Interest rates are going down. Can't argue that. Have been going down, except for the, you know, kind of mini bump you had in 1994 and the mini bump you had with the Trump election too, and the taper tantrum. But here's where I think kind of Japanification falls apart, or how it could be different. Japan to me is almost a victim of circumstance. So one of the stories that kind of explains what has happened to interest rates, before we were talking about demand for labor, demand for capital. The opening up of emerging markets and the opening up of China represented this incredible, incredible supply shock where so much labor was available, cheaper labor than was available in advanced economies, for you to harness and boost production. And then, you know, the West will supply the management, the capital, the East will supply the labor. And then, you know, you get these big trade deficits with emerging markets, especially China, but you're getting a lot cheaper goods. What this did was it kind of put downward pressure on people's wages. And also at the same time, it put downward pressure on interest rates just because all this labor was unlocked and you didn't need to invest as much in capital as you would have had these economies, these advanced economies, remained closed with a relatively smaller supply of labor. So Japan, with its aging population, and people want to associate the downward trend with the aging population, it's almost like coincidence that Japan just happened to be aging ahead of everyone else at the time when this major global labor supply was being opened up. I would assume that, you know, in a scenario where we're kind of running through more labor globally, global labor markets are tightening right now as of, you know, May. I hope that doesn't turn on me anytime soon, but they're tightening. And what do you do when you run out of labor and labor becomes more expensive? You start investing more in capital. And as the kind of advanced economies pass the hump and more people are retiring, I think you'll start to see a better balance in terms of more demand for investment, and that will put upward pressure on interest rates. I don't think it'll happen overnight. I don't think rates are going to go as crazy as they ever did during the 70s, but I do think there's a decent case to be made that these trends that were put in motion by big one-off labor shocks will reverse due to demographic reasons, kind of the exact same demographic reasons that people associate with the downward interest rates, I think.
Okay.
Inappropriately.
Okay. Very interesting. So one of the acronyms, one of the buzzwords that came out of Japan was ZERP. So what does ZERP mean? And following on that, where do you see interest rates going in North America? So first ZERP and then interest rates domestically.
So ZERP is zero interest rate policy, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's the central bank keeping its policy rates at basically zero. And since ZERP out of Japan, we've had NERP. We've had moves to negative interest rates to try and put downward pressure on currencies, to try and influence rates further out the curve, and to try to, you know, deter cash hoarding. Although, you know, central banks took steps to make sure that this wouldn't just result in a flight to cash, and which would kind of it would put a lot of capital outside the reach of their tools. They wouldn't necessarily like that. So they took steps to alleviate the worst ends of it.
And ZERP lasted for how long?
I mean,
20 years, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Japan, I'd say basically 15, 20. Yeah.
Okay. And so one of the things that I hear all the time is people say, hey, well, look what happened in Japan. They had ZERP for 2 decades. And again, using that as a model, that's what's going to happen here. So we could have interest rates for at a very low rate for a very long time. So what do you say to that?
I agree with lower for longer. I think it makes sense. I think that to a certain extent, rates aren't going to get as high as they did in previous cycles. That's because activity isn't going to get as high as it did in previous cycles. So, you know, they're just simply it's a labor kind of supply thing. GDP growth is equal to very roughly the trend growth of labor versus the trend growth in productivity. There's just not a lot of room for in advanced economies you to see a lot more trend growth in labor. And based on what we've seen over the past, let's call it decade, there's not a lot of evidence that says productivity is about to turn a corner and start shooting higher. Though, you know, as we discussed with the more demand for investment coming, I do expect that to help out a little more. Right. So where do you see interest rates going? Hey, if we're lucky, policy rates maybe get up to 3% in this cycle in the US before a recession hits and the Fed's forced to lower rates again. And Canada, since, you know, we're now at a lower point and arguably our credit cycle's a lot further along, there's good reason to suspect that Canada might have a recession if you didn't think what happened in the wake of oil was a recession. Mm-hmm. When the credit cycle turns before the US has another downturn. So in Canada, we might not be seeing it a lot higher. And then, you know, when they go back down again, you could have rates in a range of 1 to something negative from, you know, say 2008 through 2025, maybe. Who right. knows? So that could be a 15-year period where it looks like Japanification, but it isn't quite. And I think once a lot of those baby boomers sadly start to not only exit the labor force, but exit life altogether, mm-hmm. then there will be even more impetus for real interest rates to be rising.
And correct me if I'm wrong, inflation targeting as a mandate for the Bank of Canada was early 90s when it was instituted?
Yes, strictly the current target, yes.
Okay, and so with that also, I mean, unless they change the mandate, wouldn't that kind of be an anchor as to where you would see interest rates, inflation kind of hovering around if that's their policy?
There's no ironclad law that says to get 2% inflation, you need 2% policy rates. The mechanics behind it are actually, it's a lot of art and science. You have to guess kind of how fast do we think we can grow? The easy part to estimate is trend labor growth, productivity, who knows? Then you have to estimate, well, where are we? Are we at full employment right now? Do we have a little more to go? So you have to kind of figure out a baseline based on where the economy's at and kind of what interest rate then balances out to get you to that potential growth. Very hard, very hard. The bank's been reevaluating this, incredibly hard to do. The range of potential estimates they cite in terms of, you know, where rates are and what potential output is, both very wide, margin of error huge. And that's, again, something that kind of augurs for caution when you're setting interest rates.
Right. So when it comes to the mandate for the Bank of Canada, so right now they've got a target of 2, but do you want to explain that a little bit? So this is something that's talked about a lot, but I don't think a lot of sort of casual listeners may understand sort of the details of it. So just walk us through that.
Okay. The 2% inflation target, it's the bank won't overreact to any big shocks. You know, say oil supply gets cut off and then gas prices spike at the pumps. Bank won't necessarily overreact to that. But inflation is very simply, at its most basic level, it's a general rise in the price level. So they look to more core measures of inflation. They strip out the volatile stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, food, gas prices. Right now, the bank looks at 3 different core measures. They're very hard to explain. You need formulas. But what they're aimed at is trying to give you a better sense at what prices are doing generally, not what, you know, prices are doing kind of on average, or not what the outliers on prices are doing. And so basically that gives you a sense of, Is the economy overheating? Are price pressures going up all over the place? Or is price growth kind of subdued? As for the 2% target, that nature of it, it's incredibly arbitrary. But there are costs associated with a higher inflation target. The easy descriptor is menu costs. You know, a restaurant has to then print a new menu every time, prices go up, and that's a real cost to the business. That's an efficiency drag. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the cost of having it too low, say you target 0% inflation, that kind of means your room to stimulate the economy when you need to is lessened, because when you have a 2% inflation target, that means you can bring real interest rates, so interest rates adjusted for inflation, into negative territory without having to, actually move rates into negative right. territory. Central banks were scared about having to do that. It was thought it could upend the entire monetary system. So far, it hasn't done that, but they would prefer not to be under zero. And so that kind of gives them more leeway to stimulate the economy and kind of pulled out of the hat that, 2% seems, Goldilocks, not too high, not too low.
And so do you think that is the right mandate for a central bank?
There's a theory in economics basically called the divine coincidence. It says that if a central bank's doing everything right, it can have, inflation at target and employment at its full level. The hardcore monetarists will tell you that a central bank can never affect real variables in the long term. So it can never affect, employment over the long term, can never affect real growth over the long term. That's something that's kind of being evaluated right now. I think the Bank of Canada right now is showing a lot of sensitivity to the employment aspect of its mandate. They've talked a lot about labor gaps. Mm-hmm. So I think de facto central banks, especially in this environment where they're looking to be cautious, kind of do have a labor element to them, even if they are an inflation targeting central bank. Based on that divine coincidence, do we need it codified into the mandate? Maybe not. I think it's very hard to define what full employment actually is. And, central banks are the experts, man. These guys did a lot of school. They talk, live, and breathe this stuff. I'm fine with giving them discretion. in terms of figuring out where things should be. I think they have a heck of a lot better idea than I do, no matter what I might spout off on Twitter occasionally.
Well, you know what? You're only 26. I could see you as the governor of the Bank of Canada one day. I really could. Would you take the job?
That would be a very bad thing for Canada.
Oh, so it would. Why do you say that?
I just lack the I lack the background training, and I don't plan to get it. I'll put it that way.
Oh, okay. Because like I say, you're 26. You're still young, very young, and yet have accomplished so much. Okay, so let's now change gears a little bit and talk about your forecast for interest rates and how that would affect, say, the housing market. Because this is one of the questions that are getting asked all the time is people think that there's a housing bubble, and they think the thing that's going to change it is if there is any kind of market increase in interest rates or a shock to the labor market. So what's your take on all that?
So I don't think that, I don't think the Bank of Canada has been the fundamental cause mm-hmm. of what's happened in housing. Maybe at the margins, did they accelerate some activity?
So You're already petitioning for the job.
maybe they didn't. Maybe they affected it at the margin, but they said they kind of wanted to. And I don't think the Bank of Canada, in terms of doing anything with interest rates, will be the proximate cause. Mm-hmm. Might it happen at the same time where they're starting to lift interest rates sometime next year? That's kind of where both economists and bond markets see liftoff in Canada happening if everything goes well. Sometime next year, if you think what's going on in Canada is a bubble or has some elements of bubblicious behavior, and an argument I'm fairly sympathetic to, then to me it's behavioral aspects that are more important. It's non-price credit conditions. Mm-hmm. Who can get credit? How much can
anyone?
Get?
Yeah, I don't even think you actually have to have a pulse.
So, but to me, those kind of things are more important. And when you see what's going on in alternative lending in Canada these days with some of the woes people are having in terms of securing liquidity, securing financing, you're already seeing right now that lenders are being forced to raise rates without any pressure from market interest rates, without any pressure from general borrowing costs. At the same time, they're saying, crap, we have to be a little more selective in what we're taking on, both, and this is part of some of the changes the government's made, both in terms of the mortgage insurance, making that a little less readily available, stress testing people at higher rates. So at the margins, you're kind of seeing activity go down for non-market price reasons. And you know, the housing market in Canada has never been a truly free market as long as there has been a CMHC.
Yeah.
So I would say paying attention to the qualitative things, not the general trend in interest rates as set by central banks, is probably the way to go in terms of assessing the timing of anything. However, I've been completely wrong. I think in late 2014, I said 12 to 18 months, you're going to see condo prices start following.
Hey, join the club,
first,
man.
First in Montreal, then in Toronto, and then maybe you might see something in detached. So completely wrong. So take it all with a grain of salt.
But join the club.
I'll just say I'm looking at non-price credit conditions a lot more closely than general interest rates.
Okay, so when credit starts to tighten, that is potentially an inflection point.
Yes, when credit growth starts to tighten, but more importantly, like credit conditions would be your leading indicator on that. When banks say, okay, you need this credit score instead of that credit score. When banks say, okay, no, we really need to see the income verification this time. No, we're serious. We need to see it.
Can't be in crayon. Now it's actually got to be on a form.
Yeah. When those sorts of things start happening and again, this is things you'll get more from anecdotal evidence and people who watch this very closely. I'm following Ben Rabideau, so there's a guy you can talk to about that kind of stuff. I think that's what you should be looking at in terms of assessing the timing.
Okay, so you're currently in New York. Let's say you got relocated to Toronto. And let's say, it, even from your perspective, would be a long-term move. Let's say you're going to be here for 10 years. Even though you're a millennial, you'll probably end up, Singapore, Japan, somewhere.
Mars.
Yeah, maybe even Mars. So you move back to Toronto. Do you buy a condo right now?
Oh, no.
Emphatic no.
Yeah. I would never like to. I'd like to have a family someday, and I would not like to raise them in a condo. I do see, a value in having a piece of something that you own, property ownership as a point of pride. I get all that, but I don't get that from a little box in the sky. And if I want to get something that I think actually has an appreciation aspect to it, I want something with land. I don't want the box in the sky. The land is what will appreciate, if anything. So I'd if anything, buy a detached house, but I wouldn't do that either. I would be sitting out and waiting, but this credit cycle has gone on a long time and I wouldn't like to mark the top. I thought the construction at Honest Ed's, turning that into a condo, I thought that would be the symbolic top for the market. So I'm kind of waiting on that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So detached house. So assuming you had the capital available to buy a detached house in Toronto, which I believe the average price now is $35 million or something like that.
Rounded down.
Yeah. Would you buy a house then?
I'd be more willing to consider it than a condo, but still no.
Okay. So you'd wait.
Yes.
And how long would you wait? Would you wait for 20% correction, 30%? If this turns, how severe do you think that downturn could be?
A fellow I worked with at the Globe, Scott Barlow, he said it's waiting for corrections to play out. And it's all well and good to know something that is going to happen, but waiting for it to play out is always the difficult part.
Yeah.
I'm sure I would find that the difficult part. But again, the good thing is access to credit will probably be fairly tight in the wake of any housing bust. So I don't think I'm the kind of guy that would be able to get one when he might want one to try and cherry pick a bottom or come in at the bottom of the market. So I'd be waiting a while. I'd be I'd be on the wrong end of it. I'd rather wait for things to start moving up than try and catch them on their way down.
Do you have friends in Toronto who are buying in this market?
I do, but the crazier thing is I just see more and more on Facebook who are real estate agents. I tell you, the anecdotal evidence is crazy. Real estate, in some case, real estate agents or in like self-made reno, mom and pop kind of outfits. And it's the hype is real. If my Facebook feed is any representative sample.
Okay. So let's change gears again. And as we are starting to wrap up here, you're a guy who's really plugged into business news and the economy. How do you invest your own money? Are you a passive guy? Are you active? What are your general thoughts on?
Completely passive, except for, you know, you try and be smart and you maybe want to pick one or two things that you think are winners for mainly just your own point of pride.
So you're like a core satellite kind of guy.
Yeah, more or less. But I'd say, you know, I'd say 50 to 60% of what I've got is invested in the Russell. And so U.S. small caps and the biggest buys I ever made were in, you know, early January 2015. Things looked really bad off the get-go of the year. Just there were three straight days where everything fell fairly big, like over 1% each. And I said, well, this is one they tell you to buy, right?
Right.
Like,
yes.
So I bought. I haven't looked at them since. And then, you know, periodically try to put more capital in at scheduled intervals. I think the mistake I've made recently, which is a good learning lesson, is trying to market time the other way, saying, hey, I won't put it in now because just things look too frothy. Like, what do I know? Stocks usually go up. So I have not put enough in recently on scheduled intervals, and it's been because, you know, things look too high. That's been a bad reason.
Right.
As it turns out, I regret it. I'll regret it even if stocks go down by 10% tomorrow, because I've still missed out on even more than that. So
okay, so that's interesting. So 50% plus, 50 to 60% is index funds?
Yes.
And where's your home bias? Do you identify now, because you live in the U.S., do you have a heavy home bias to U.S. stocks? Or you see yourself as Canadian, you have a heavy home bias to Canadian stocks?
I mean, I plan to retire here, so
okay.
Having over half in U.S. dollar assets has proved to be just fabulous. That makes me very happy. I'm very glad that's happened. And in terms of a home bias, I obviously have one, but I'm also I have dual citizenship. So I guess that's my home bias representative perfectly. I've split between Canada and U.S. small caps, and man, hey, that's what my passports are.
Okay. So slightly more than 50% are in passively managed securities, but you're kind of taking an active slant with them because you're modifying your contribution strategy based on how you're seeing the market.
But I shouldn't be doing that.
Right.
I shouldn't be doing that.
Right. I'm trying to scold you here.
Yes.
Okay. Last thing is if people want to learn more about economics, basics, medium level, intermediate level, what are some of the resources that you recommend? Like, who are the people to follow on Twitter besides yourself? Who are the people to follow on Twitter? Is there sort of a general entry level textbook for people to pick up? Are there online courses to read? What's your advice to people?
In terms of stuff to read, I think Twitter, although it's a whirlwind, it's absolutely great. Folks, I'd recommend a Canadian American like myself, George Perks, in terms of North American macro, and then also rest of the world. He's a guy who knows his stuff inside and out, very accessible. You can ask a lot of questions.
Do you know his Twitter handle off the top of your head?
Yes, it's Perks, P-E-A-R-K-E-S.
All right, George Perks.
George Perks, the whole crew that was the McLean's EconoWatch crew once upon a time. That's, you know, Stephen F. Gordon, Mike P. Moffitt. And the Worthwhile Canadian Initiative crew, that's Francis Woolley, Macro Nick Rowe at Carleton. Jennifer Robson is another fabulous resource. I'm going to forget people and they're going to be really mad at me. Francis Donald at Manulife.
What about the Alberta contingent?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about Andrew Leach, of course. Trevor Toom, if I'm pronouncing that right. Sorry, Trevor. Kristen Smith, another one. It's like so many, and this is all Canadian, and this is the great part. This is a great part for me when I was getting started. You know, there's people there, as long as you're not really a you know what, you can ask questions and you can learn. And as long as you're genuinely curious and not trying to just, you know, show off or showboat or, you know, pick at flaws, there's a lot that can be learned. And the Canadian crowd is, you know, we live up to our name. We're fairly polite, fairly accessible, and they're trying to help. In terms of textbooks, to me, all of economics, and especially at the macro level, I'd like to look, you know, 30,000 feet down at things. It's all about problem solving. So a great way to kill two birds with one stone is read a lot of economic history. I find that very fascinating. Besides the whole dealing with an aging population and the constraints of that, there's pretty much nothing new under the sun in terms of major macro questions. And early economic thought is something that stuck with me. It was in my favorite course in university. That was one of the books we used. It's the author's last name is Monroe, I believe, and it's fabulous. It kind of walks you through from Aristotle. He didn't just do the philosophy thing. He had some things to say about economics.
And sorry, what was the title of that book again?
Early Economic Thought.
Early Economic Thought.
You can see it on Amazon. It's like a pale greenish color, I think. I do not get a percent of sales, but maybe I should. You know, takes you through Aristotle to, you know, the guy in France, Canet, who wrote the first economic model, kind of the tableau économique, and all the way up to Hume. So it's a really good overview of kind of the challenges they faced at the time and how they dealt with it. And when I think what most people are trying to get at with economics is how do we solve these fiscal problems or these cyclical problems using, you know, government or monetary tools that we're having? And that's the question, the general question that all these folks have been grappling with throughout history.
Okay, excellent. And as bonus content, because I think you wrote about this, can you describe the story behind what Zero Hedge is and how it's generally regarded on the street?
So to give the very brief run through on that, this is something I had the second byline on, and I got to pitch in with. I'm very lucky to do it. Tracy Alloway, who is also just she's more corporate credit and in the, you know, in the bowels of the credit market and the money markets, but she's an invaluable and hilarious resource to follow. Tracy Alloway on Twitter. She's my boss, and she kind of roped me in on this story. Just Zero Hedge is a very bearish, sometimes comically outlandishly so financial blog that is adored and has a very loyal, large contingent, including many who do work on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. and were very upset when one gentleman who was writing there, who was fairly disillusioned with what he was doing, kind of just reached out to us and just gave us the lowdown on who was behind it and what they were doing and kind of what they thought of their own work. And, you know, surprise, surprise, they thought of it like a business and they were, you know, looking to make money. Did they necessarily believe in their conspiratorial manifesto as much as it may have appeared? No, it turns out they did not. So it was a very fun story. Received a lot of feedback on other side of the lines. Incredibly happy to have been a part of it.
And what happened? Do you know what happened to readership of Zero Hedge after that story? Has it plateaued? Has it continued to grow?
I have absolutely no idea, but kind of in this era, one thing about news, and I'm very happy I work in financial news, even though I'm not doing the hardcore reporting that a lot of good folks are doing, but a lot of news has become, you know, more geared around confirming your biases and
right,
reading things that you're comfortable with. So I would suspect that folks who were comfortable with that content before are still comfortable with it after. I'm happy to be in finance where, you know, this matters. It doesn't matter. It matters, but it doesn't matter whether or not you think the ex-president was, you know, born in America or born outside America. That's not going to personally affect, unless you're, you know, very loud about it and lose your job over being kind of crazy on that end. That's not going to affect your personal welfare and your family's welfare. If you believe, you know, crazy things about, say, if you don't know GICs are insured, if you don't know, you know, the power of compound interest, if you don't know those kind of things and you're not looking in those right places, then like that's just going to cost you over the long term. So I'm glad to be in a part of news where it really still does matter and has the more tangible impact.
All right. Very good. So as you know, at the end of every episode, everyone gets a minute or two to give themselves a commercial. You can plug your Twitter account, where they can find you online, any projects that you're working on. So the floor is yours. Tell people whatever you'd like to tell them.
Laura's mine. Okay. Twitter account, LJKAWA. That's where I'm at. Obviously, just like this, any opinions there are very personal. Do not hold them against my employer. If anything, please hold them against the Financial Post. That's just, that'd be fine with me. One thing I'm working on right now that I'm very interested in is I'm doing an Asia daily newsletter. So for you folks in this part of the world, you'd be getting it right around, right before kind of dinner time or on your way home. It's kind of geared at both a look ahead at what's going on in the rest of the world in the day ahead, as well as what's transpired in the past day. So I'd love to get readership for that up. And I'm putting that out on the daily. If you're on my Twitter feed, you will see that there. That's a good thing. And one last plug I'll give, Silver Creek Nursery School, and I believe it's the only school in Toronto that does service children that are born with special needs. And my mother runs the school. She has been running it for a long time. She recently was able to, with some government help, make sure that it stays open. And I know that contributions to their charitable arm do go a long way in helping those kids and making sure that that continues to happen too.
Very good. I will personally make a contribution tonight. Luke, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your insights and expertise. I think our listeners have gotten a lot of valuable information from you.
Hey, I hope so. Just, you know, don't compare me to Ben Rabideau.
Hey, listen, you hold your own by all means. And to the listeners, don't forget to leave a rating and comment on iTunes. It helps me to get top-notch guests on the podcast like Luke. And that is it for this week. We will see you next time.